Okay. Right, here we go. Hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and I'm back in Auckland for this week's edition of Crave, a podcast about films, music, television, anything else which has been entertaining Steve McCabe and I over the last week or so. We'll be talking about The Martian, featuring a rather lonely Matt Damon.
Simon will be taking a look at Everest.
And Steve's been to the theatre this week. He's got some reports from Cats and from South Pacific.
And Simon's been enjoying the musical delights of Barcelona. Yeah, that'll work. We'll take that. Right, well, we'll start with usual, with films. The Martian, Simon. Gripping stuff, or is it just a recruitment video for NASA?
Well, here's the thing. I reckon it's both. I think it's both. I think there's some genuinely gripping drama in it.
Yep.
And I couldn't help but feel, as you watch the story, that, yes, this is the best PR for NASA you could possibly get. We'll get on to that a bit more in a moment, but let's just quickly set this thing up. The film starts with a NASA mission to Mars. We've got astronauts on the planet conducting research. A terrible storm comes along. They've got to abandon the mission. And as they get out of the place, one of them, called Mark Watney, played by Matt Damon, gets left behind because of a terrible accident. The crew thinks he's dead. They've got no choice. They've got to leave. And the film takes us on this story about A, how Matt Damon or Mark Watney survives and what he has to do to survive, and also what can NASA and the crew do to bring him back home. That's the track of the story, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah, I think you make a good point that there are basically two almost separate, certainly parallel stories going on in this film. On the one hand, you've got Watney trying to survive on Mars, which is oddly, somehow a rather flat story. I found altogether more gripping and altogether more fascinating was the human drama that was taking place on Earth. The discussions on not only how they were going to try and recover this fellow, but whether they should try and get him back. I found that altogether more compelling.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the thing is, when you're just by yourself, the only interaction he's got is with himself when you see him talking to the camera, making, you know, video diaries of his time there. And there's only so much dramatic tension you can get out of that. I mean, things can go wrong, but he doesn't have anyone else to play off. Mm. Oh, I think he does a pretty good job. I think he's a likable and engaging actor. And I always like looking at Matt Damon. I think he's a good actor. And he has to bring some humor into it just to jolly things along a little bit, don't you think?
Well, he tries very hard. But as you say, it's a very solitary role for him. Most of the time, he's effectively talking to himself. The conceit that Ridley Scott, the director, came up with was to place GoPro cameras, or at least the illusion of GoPro cameras dotted around the residential hub on Mars. And so it's as though he's recording a captain's log as he makes his way between the various bits of the station. And that's all he really gets to do. He's effectively talking to himself in the guise of recording a diary of his time as he's alone. So basically he's monologuing his way through it. And they do their best to develop some tension. But for the most part, he has an idea, he implements it. He has another idea, he implements that idea. And with one notable exception where you're almost expecting, there's the peril. And
yes.
Well done, they've resolved the peril. And now we can move on.
Yeah.
And it felt a little bit perfunctory. And really what I got out of the On Mars stuff was it was gorgeous to look at. It was a fantastic piece of filmmaking in that regard. It was beautiful to see. And I think a lot of that is down to Gravity, last year's Sandra Bullock masterpiece, which set a very high standard now for the kind of visual effects we expect from an in-space film.
Yeah.
So the footage on the craft that was bringing the five survivors back to Earth, for example, phenomenally filmed. And the footage apparently is filmed in Jordan, in the deserts of Jordan.
Yeah.
The footage on Mars was stunningly beautiful, but the story plodded to a certain degree. That's the wrong word, isn't it? That's not fair.
Well, I'll tell you why it sort of plodded, and that's because although there is some dramatic tension back on Earth about the morals and the ethics involved and when do you risk other people to bring one person back, this is not a movie where you have necessarily a lot of bad guys. You know, I mean, there's the head of NASA who's grappling with should he risk, you know, more astronauts to bring Matt Damon back. But, yeah, there's no big there's no space alien. There's no bad guy. There's that element of a what you might consider a normal drama isn't really quite there. And I just want to bring in this whole thing of the PR for NASA here.
Yes.
Because there, you know, NASA is portrayed as a multicultural organization, quite a touchy-feely one. Everyone chips in. They'll go and seek help and get help from the Chinese to bring this all to fruition. People on the lower ranks can come up with wonderful ideas and have them promoted, and that can lead to the rescue possibly being successful. I don't know. And NASA's all over this, and there's been a lot said about the timing of this big news story about the confirmation that water was on Mars pretty much the same week as the movie comes out, and you can't help but think if NASA wants to take the most out of pushing the message it's doing good work out there, it needs your support. A real double banger here with that news story about water and the movie at the same time.
Oh, you cynic. You utter cynic.
Oh, it's true. Come on.
You could be onto something there. It is a splendid coincidence otherwise, isn't it?
It is.
But the film itself is well put together. The stuff on the ground was highly entertaining. I thought Jeff Daniels as Teddy. The head of NASA's called Teddy? Seriously? But he was fabulous. He played a wonderful combination of absolutely sentimental pushover and hard-nosed accountant. He was quite excellent. Sean Bean as the project manager, well, yeah, we're not totally sure what exactly he was all over the place. He was gruff and hard in Yorkshire half the time, and the other time
he can't help but be there.
No, he didn't actually die for a change in this film.
now could we just say without giving too much away, Mr. McCabe,
go ahead.
I mentioned the humor in this, but there's this particular scene where there's some of the NASA team on Earth having a discussion, and they talk about they make reference to another well-known movie franchise, and the obvious humor here of having one of the actors in this NASA team having been in the movie franchise is, I thought, what's going on? This is frivolous. This is indulgent. What's Ridley Scott up to here? What are we meant to make of this?
Okay, I confess I've lost the reference. You're going to have to fill me
in. I will just spell that out. We, at one point in the NASA conferences, they make talk of it having a Council of Elrond.
Of course.
Which was from The Lord of the Rings. And Sean Bean, who's in the room, the NASA room, talking about this, was in the Council of Elrond, the Lord of the Rings film. So what was going on there, for crying out loud?
I can't believe I missed that. I'm deeply ashamed of myself.
He's talking to a New Zealander here who's seen these New Zealand-made films more than once, I have to say, just quietly. Just keep that to yourself. But, I just thought that was indulgent, and it made you just kind of wonder. I just thought, what are we being played with a little bit here?
Oh, just a little bit.
Yes.
I confess I've not read the original novel, so I'm not that familiar with the source material. I'm going to have to go back and revisit it. It's entirely possible that they worked that one in there. I think one of the great underrated talents in the film is a gentleman whose name I still struggle to pronounce correctly. I believe it's pronounced Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Who played Vincent Kapoor, who is the mission leader, I believe, from the ground.
Yep.
We last saw him in 12 Years a Slave, when he was phenomenal in that. He's, again, utterly brilliant in The Martian. Overall, I thought it was a very, very interesting film. I would like to have had more character development of the astronauts. I struggled to care enough about Mark Watney.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. One of the things that I there's a little question there that you had to accept straight away, right at the beginning of this whole story is, and that is this absolutely terrible disaster happens to this guy, and pretty much he doesn't panic. He is up positive pretty much from day one, and he is just going to keep, as he says, sciencing the shit out of it until he solves it. And comes back to the whole PR thing. This is NASA on top of their game. Their people are positive. They're problem solvers. They don't give up. And, boy, do you want to support this organization. This is my cynical little side coming back. And I did enjoy it. I did, but I didn't. I wanted to enjoy it a little bit more than I did.
Yeah. Now, I think you're onto something there, to be honest. Certainly back in the US, where what I remember is there is a certain degree of hero worship within NASA. Astronauts are American heroes. They have the right stuff and so on and so forth. And so very definitely we're offered this example of a man who has absolute grace under pressure. He's calm and he is measured. And yeah, even though he's suddenly the only person on the entire planet and he's got 1 year's worth of food to last him 4 years until they can get back to recover him, he simply works his way through it because he's calm and he's composed and he's going to survive. It's a little bit too easy on that level. I would have liked to have seen a bit more. And also, since we're having a bit of a criticise here, for the most part, the science of the Martian is decent, but the basic premise is wrong. You don't get storms on Mars, or at least not storms as we know them. There's virtually no atmosphere on the planet. You can't get colossal, massive winds. If the winds are moving as fast as they made them out to be in the film, it would feel like a stiff breeze at best. You're not going to get that kind of cataclysmic disaster simply from wind on Mars.
You've done the research on this, have you, Steve?
Physics teacher, mate. Physics teacher. You know I'm going to.
All right. I'll take your word for that. Well, that's a rather gaping hole in the premise of the whole film, isn't it?
It sort of deconstructs it from about 2 minutes in.
All right. Okay.
Which, again, was one of the problems of the film. The disaster that sets it up for its entire premise, the disaster that leads to him being stranded on Mars, happens within the first minute and a half, 2 minutes of the film.
Yes.
There's not really much of a setup. Right? We're on Mars, and we're off. They really hit the ground running here, and as a result, so I say, the five astronauts who escape Mars, there is virtually no character development for those five. They are very caricatured.
I agree with that. I would have liked to have got to know those actors better, and there were some good actors among them, that's for sure. Okay, so we've found a few holes in this, but what do you think? Where do you sit at the end of it on this one? What sort of recommendation are you going to give to someone else, Steve?
Well, I'd say I would definitely buy a ticket for this. I think it's worth seeing, flaws and all. In the end, it's entertaining. As I say, it's beautiful to look at. There's some decent humour from Matt Damon. There's some phenomenal supporting actors on the ground. Yeah, buy a ticket. What do you reckon?
I would say same thing. Despite all the reservations, despite my inherent cynicism, I actually quite enjoyed it. I do like space films. I do like Matt Damon. It is well put together. And yes, every now and then you feel like you've been taken a bit of a PR ride by NASA, but I would still say it's worth seeing. Right, so that's what we think about The Martian. I've been to another film as well this week, Steve. Also up in the atmosphere, but not right above, far away as Mars, and this is on the top of Everest, the film Everest. Have you caught this one this week?
No, I didn't get a chance to see this. I was supposed to see it. I had a press screening ticket, and it was the night I was seeing Cats.
Oh, well, Cats has to take precedence. But shall I quickly tell you about Everest before we move on to Cats?
Tell us about Everest. What did you make of it? As the resident Kiwi in the podcast, what did you make of it?
So, Everest. This is a really interesting one to try and get your head around, especially if you are a New Zealander, because it's based on a real event, this terrible tragedy at Everest in 1996, when actually several parties, climbing parties, including one led by the New Zealander Rob Hall, struck trouble, hit by a storm, a real storm, unlike the one that was allegedly taking place on Mars, real storm on the top of Everest, and several deaths resulted. So it had huge coverage at the time. It's still talked about to this day. And So for many New Zealanders, I think, Stephen, if you were around at the time, it's just kind of an interesting thing. But how you approach a film like this, I guess it's not a straight out documentary, but it's not just a drama either. It's a docudrama.
Right.
All the people you are looking at are real people, based on real people. You may be pretty familiar with the story. So let's just go through it just quickly. You've got this is at a time that the movie sets this up when there's a lot of competition to get to the top of Everest. There are parties from New Zealand, Australia, America, South Africa, leading climbers up there. And that leads to complications. It leads to competition. It leads maybe when you've got people who are so desperate to get to the top of the world where the people leading the expeditions maybe are taking one or two more risks than they should just to help that person fulfill their lifelong ambition of seeing the top of the world. That's kind of what lies behind this. Visually, it's fantastic. I couldn't get to see it in 3D. It would have been great if I did. But even in 2D, it's a fantastic-looking film.
Right.
Kathmandu and Nepal look wonderful. The mountain looks impressive. There's a cast of characters and actors here like Jake Gyllenhaal, Josh Brolin, Keira Knightley, Robin Wright, some pretty top-notch actors. There are New Zealand references all the way through. Of course, most of the key actors are, key roles are New Zealanders. We've got a bit of Crowded House music thrown in there. We've got some shots of Christchurch. It's got that flavour. We hear about Hillary, Edmund Hillary. So the New Zealand-ness is there right the way through. But how does it work as just an ordinary, not ordinary, as a drama? Again, that's the question, because you've got all these different people. So which character thread do you follow? And I think that is possibly one of the slight problems it's got in presenting a real story. Rob Hall's the leader, but you've got this big actor, American actor Josh Brolin, and the camera seems to spend a lot of time on him. I'm not necessarily sure if he's the most important person in the real story, but he becomes one of the most important people in this movie version of it. And later on, though, the focus shifts back to Rob Hall, the key character. I think that was a really genuine attempt to tell the story. I've heard some people weren't convinced it absolutely got everything right. I think that's a big ask anyway. It's not an absolute documentary. I think for New Zealanders, they would get a lot out of it. It's a pretty sad story. Even though I knew it was going to happen at the end, I still found it a pretty emotional ending. If you're familiar with this, Steve, it's one of the things people will remember about this is at the very, very end of this, the expedition leader, Rob Hall, was able to make a satellite phone call to his pregnant wife in Christchurch while he's dying on the top of Everest. And they had a conversation.
Now, this raises two very, very important questions. First of all, given that there's a very close Kiwi connection here, and we live in a very small country where, let's face it, everybody knows everybody else, is this entertainment? We're telling the story of people that either we know or we are not distantly connected to in massive, massive peril. Can we really consider this to be entertainment?
No, I didn't find it entertaining. I found it gripping at times and dramatic. But I guess I went on this to this steeling myself for a difficult watch, because I thought, even though I don't personally know these people, it feels pretty close to home to me. So it wasn't, you're not going there for a night out of entertainment. You're going there to sort of revisit a piece of modern New Zealand history in a gripping and dramatic way. Yeah.
Fair enough. Now, we are also dancing around the issue of how the film resolves itself very much. We've been very careful how we word the outcomes of the film. But as you say, this is a true story, and especially in New Zealand, it's a very well-known true story.
Yes.
It's well-documented, and a lot of people are going to be very familiar with the outcome of it. Is it reasonable to be concerned about spoilers in such a true story? I mean, I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I had some students when I was teaching in Japan who told me they'd been to see Titanic. And they said, are you going to see it? And I said, no, I know what happens at the end. It sinks. And they said, how do you know that? And I just wept quietly. So,
oh, no.
So in a story like this, where a lot of people are going to be very, very familiar with the details of the story, and possibly will even be at least indirectly connected to the principles of the story. How much do we need to be concerned about spoilers?
Yeah, we don't. We don't really, especially for a New Zealand audience. So it ends. So it's really, we know it's going to happen. It's just the way they treat the ending, which is the point. And the way they've done this is a tragedy. There are several deaths. Key people in the story die. One does survive, apparently against all odds. And that little survival story is told in the sequence to give this film a bit of an up.
Right.
And just so you don't feel utterly devastated. And I guess in that sense, it does work reasonably well. And then, as often is the case in films like this these days, at the very end, you see the actual photographs of the people involved. And that actually is quite a powerful little sequence, I think. I think it works pretty well. It's not an easy watch. Perhaps an international audience not so familiar with it might have different responses. I'm glad I saw it. I would recommend people to see it, but don't expect this to be grim at times, but well told. That's my view.
So maybe not a date movie then.
Now, where are we? I think we better go and talk some music, shouldn't we, Steve? Actually, we better just remind people that this is Crave with Steve McCabe and Simon Mercer. This is our, we call it a weekly, fortnightly podcast, depending on what sort of mood we're in and we're talking about movies.
Well, it also depends largely on what country you're in, Simon, to be fair.
Have been enjoying some kind of interesting musical performances lately. Tell me about that.
It's not usually my thing, to be honest, but when I should have been at Everest, instead I was taking the family to see Cats at the Civic in Auckland. Now, this is a show that I've fancied for years. I am, oddly enough, something of a fan of Andrew Lloyd Webber, which I know is a hideously unfashionable thing to say, but there was a time early in his career when he actually produced some very, very exciting and groundbreaking music.
Oh, we remember Jesus Christ Superstar.
Which was indeed phenomenal. I mean, he's got Ian Gillan from Deep Purple on the original cast recording. It's fantastic stuff. He was a rocker at one time, long before the nonsense of things like Starlight Express and Phantom of the Opera, when he really lost the plot. There was a time when he was producing some really, really strong music. And Cats is right on the cusp of transitioning from, man, this guy's got some talent, to, really? And so Cats sits right on the very edge of it. And I'd always been told that it was an amazing spectacle to see live. So I got the opportunity to see it in Auckland a couple of weeks ago. Took the family along. And started to realise that possibly there's a reason why I hadn't seen it.
Okay.
And yes, it was good. It was very entertaining. It's still playing, because if anyone's interested in going to see it, it's worth a look. When it's good, it's superb. And when it's not good, it drags.
Okay, when is it good and when is it not good?
Who was superb. The Rum Tum Tugger is the name of the cat. I'm almost embarrassed saying it. But it's
a better you than me.
Yeah, we'll edit that bit out, I'm sure. Daniel Assetta, he's an Australian performer, and he played the Rum Tum Tugger, who actually got to perform by far the best song in the show, Mr. Mistopheles. The guy's got a fantastic voice. He's got a swing to his delivery. It was great fun. There were, oddly enough, some very, very clunky moments also featuring the same singer. He got to do a bit of a hip-hop addition to his signature tune that was added apparently in the 1990s to make it all street and hip and down with the kids, and it doesn't work. He tries. It doesn't work. And so you end up with beautiful, beautiful moments. You know, the big show-stopping song from Cats is Memory. And it was performed quite beautifully. But then there were other bits that just simply dragged and were slow. And we're thinking, okay, can we pick this up a little bit now, please? I had a child sitting behind me. She was probably about 10, 11 years old. And I heard her asking her mum, is it nearly over yet? And that's not a good sign for a show.
A telling sign.
Oh, it's terrible. Apparently, as productions go, it's extremely faithful to the original. It's basically lots of people in cat leotards, which is every bit as cheesy as it sounds.
Yes.
But by God, the dancing is phenomenal. They are truly feline. Wow. You could almost believe you're looking at cats on stage.
Yeah. Is this, you know, I just got to ask you, is this type of musical, is it the whole idea of it, is it gone? Is it had it used by date? Or is there, I mean, okay, you've got an issue about Andrew Lloyd Webber and how he kind of cashed in. But this type of show, is it in the modern digital age, is it really relevant anymore? I don't know.
No. Let's be blunt about this. I mean, the tagline they used to have in the West End in London was "Cats now and forever," and yeah, that was a bit ambitious. Obviously, I'm saying no, not really. I went with the best will in the world. I used to, this is a shameful admission. This I actually used to own the soundtrack album when I was younger on vinyl.
Ooh,
I know, and I used to listen to it from time to time because it was fairly good. Yeah. But yeah, I'm not going to be digging it out anytime soon. There's definitely a sell-by date on this, and I think it was probably somewhere in the mid 90s.
About you having a run-in with the mayor of Auckland, the super city of Auckland.
It is a super city, isn't it?
Isn't it?
As cities go, it's pretty super. But as we were on our way out, Len Brown, of all people, nearly killed my mother-in-law. Which is obviously a story we're going to have to embellish a little bit. The reality is we're just walking out onto Queen Street there, walking back toward the car park. And my mother-in-law, who had come along with us in the evening, and she's not the youngest lady in the world. I'll not disclose her age in public, obviously, because she'd kill me. But yeah, she's walking along and suddenly very nearly tripped over the gentleman in front of her. There's a bit of a crowd, and she tripped over his feet, reached out, grabbed his arm, and he very gallantly picked her up and dusted her off. And I turned around and realised it was indeed Mayor Len Brown who'd very nearly killed my mother-in-law.
Well, I hope he was apologetic.
Oh, he was perfectly charming and lovely. He's actually quite a nice bloke, to be honest.
Good. So you recovered that situation?
Absolutely. And my mother-in-law's been dining out on that story for the last 2 weeks.
And I don't blame her.
Why not?
Yes. Now, you said you went to Cats at the Civic.
I did.
What did you make of the Civic as a theatre, as a place to go and watch a performance?
Spectacular.
And you're a man from the UK. I guess you've been to a few theatres in that part of the world. How does the Civic compare with, say, other theatres in Britain?
It holds up. It's quite a phenomenal place, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm very, very impressed.
I'm leading you down a path here.
I can see that.
With this line of questioning.
Where are you taking me, Simon?
I'm taking you from the Civic to the Palau de la Música Catalana or Catalana.
Easy in for Barcelona. You to say.
Yeah, it is. Well, I don't know. That's if I got it right, it's easy to say. In Barcelona, this was the last night of my stay in the city.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The Palau de la Música Catalana was where I went to see the Barcelona Guitar Trio.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Now, when we were told, oh, we organized some Spanish guitar music on your last night in Barcelona. And I know when you go to Barcelona, Steve, you like to catch some guitar music, don't you?
Every single time.
I thought, oh, we're just going to a little cafe with some tapas and it's going to be a crowded little bar with two or three blokes in a corner on some stools bashing out the Spanish guitar and it'll be rather nice, cozy, intimate little evening.
Sounds good so far.
That's my expectations. But no, the Palau de la Música Catalana makes the Civic look rather ordinary. It's the most beautiful, ornate, grand theatre. The decorations are wonderful. There's coloured glass which affects the lighting. It's just beautiful. It takes your breath away. And it took me a while just to get my head around where I was sitting, let alone start to absorb the music.
See, this is not a good sign. When you're telling me about the setting, not the performance, I'm starting to wonder where are we going with this?
No, I'm just laying the groundwork here.
Fair enough. Then
the musicians come on.
There's right.
Three blokes, Manuel, Xavier and Luis. And I mean, I know what Spanish guitar sounds like. I haven't listened to a lot of it in my life. Have you dabbled in that at all, Steve?
Flamenco-style guitar?
I've listened.
I've never really fully grasped it. But, every now and then.
You kind of get a sense of what we're in store for. So these three guys come out and they do a variety of songs, ballads and quick songs and salsas and tangos. And there's three of them. There's the older one, Manuel. He's the senior guy. He does most of the ballads. You've got Xavier, who's a lovely touch player, and Luis, who is just fantastic, the best actual technician on the guitar. And his fingers are flying in all directions. And it's just wonderful to listen to. Then into the mix, you add some dancers. A young man and a young woman who were not named in the program, coming on from time to time, adding the flamenco dance. And that was fantastic. There's something, not just the movements with their bodies, but there's something about the way their faces just emit all the emotion that's within their body. It's a mixture of a vulnerability and bravado.
Okay.
About that Spanish machismo, but yet it's vulnerable at the same time. Fantastic. And I was... Yeah, wonderful to look at. Their feet and their movements were brilliant. And two thoughts struck me at the same time. Does it ever happen to you? You think one thing and immediately you think the opposite. The young man was slim and quite tall. As I was watching him doing this twirling and his feet tapping and his gestures, I thought, who does this remind me of? There's something about this guy that just, and I realized it made me think of Michael Jackson.
Oh, dear.
Something of not the crotch grabbing, but some of the flourishes of Michael Jackson, the twirls and the pose, that sort of the chin up and the sort of the I'm here, I'm in your face. There's something of that just made me think of that, and I thought I had two conflicting thoughts. Was this guy I was looking at on stage, was he drawing from Michael Jackson?
Yes.
Or was it the other way around? And in fact, was this flamenco style, of course, has been around for centuries, and is Michael Jackson seeing that and thinking, oh, that looks pretty good.
What a fascinating thought.
Yeah, so I had this conflicting, and I couldn't quite resolve it, but it did make it a fascinating evening. Really, I enjoyed Barcelona very much anyway, but it was a fantastic end to it. It was about an hour and a half. The audience was on their feet three or four times at the end, wanting more, just captivating and brilliant. And if you do go to Barcelona, Steve, I know it's on your list.
Next summer pass through.
Just go to the Palau de la Música Catalana to see the Spanish Barcelona guitar trio and the flamenco dancers. You will not be disappointed, or I will take you to a tapas bar and the night will be on me if you're disappointed.
I don't think you should be an either or here. I think I can see both happening.
Time to talk about some TV now.
Very quickly, South Pacific.
Oh, of course. Yes.
I ought to really, because I went and they did try very hard. So I feel like I owe them a quick review.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, that's kind of the basis I'm doing this on. It's not going to be a you have to see this, because I have to be honest, it was a touch disappointing. Ooh. Having seen this, say what you will about Cats, it is an amazing production. Production value is extraordinarily high. It's a fantastic spectacle. The music, in the end, frankly, dull. But the production is astonishing.
Okay.
So a couple of nights later, I found myself next door at the Town Hall in Auckland.
Yes.
And if I'm being absolutely honest, I was there to accompany my wife, who's a big musicals fan, rather than out of great interest for myself, but I went along because that's the kind of gentleman I am. And
what a guy.
Well, we'll put it this way. Debbie owes me one. It was a very, very good amateur dramatic production. Let's say that.
Okay.
And that's about the level it worked at. You ask about Cats having passed its sell-by date. I mean, South Pacific goes back to the 1950s. And it really is starting to show its age. I mean, the songs themselves are simplistic and creaky, and I thought, if I hear Bally High sung one more time, I am actually going to have to start taking lives. It was just not working for me.
I'm just trying to think of some of the other songs that were. Was it Wash That Man Out of My Hair? Did that come from South Pacific?
Yes, it did. Yes, we were treated to that one. It's again very cheesy and very corny. And
yes,
and I mean, Rodgers and Hammerstein made a career out of this kind of stuff. Lord knows how. It was not brilliant. And again, I asked Debbie, because she's a fan of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, said, well, what'd she make of it?
It wasn't bad. Ah. And that really was about the best we could come up with it. I mean, I got so disengaged from the show itself that I started deconstructing the plot in my head as I was listening. I mean, famously, it supposedly deals with racism. So there's one song, You've Got to Be Taught, that reminds people that we're not born racist, we have to be taught to despise the other. And so it's very, very forward thinking. And yet, the one central character, Bloody Mary, is basically a caricatured South Pacific Islander who's played fundamentally as Widow Twanky out of Aladdin. It was seriously, it felt like a pantomime performance at some stages, which is odd from a show that was supposedly in its time very groundbreaking in its race relations politics.
So this is a historical interest then.
It's a period piece. It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and
also, Steve, you just said, I think you put your, a key point you raised. It's an amateur production. These aren't professionals. Do you have to take that into account?
No. It is a professional show.
Oh, it's a professional show.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's got people like Geraldine Brophy from Shortland Street in it.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Bronwyn Touré from Go Girls. These are well-established performers. Who failed to impress me, to be perfectly honest. It was not as brilliant as it should have been. It really wasn't. I was a bit disappointed. I mean, don't take my word for it. It's still playing. They're doing Gisborne yet. They're doing Napier. They're getting all the way down to the South Island over during the course of October. Don't take my word for it. Go and see it yourself. But I won't be there.
About things you like to do. You got to have a dream. If you don't have a dream, how you gonna have a dream come true?
Now, I jumped the gun with my previous reference of television. I got ahead of myself in time, but then that's not surprising because...
How appropriate. I see what you did there. Very good.
Oh, I'm thinking of my feet here. So, yes, the last mention is to do with a time traveller, isn't it, on TV, Mr. McKay? One you rather like, I understand.
Oh, I have been a hardcore Doctor Who fan ever since they rebooted it with a guy from Salford as the Doctor.
But since Christopher Eccleston, there have been a whole bunch of other Doctor Whos. The latest one is Peter Capaldi, Steve. This is the beginning of the second season of his run as Doctor Who.
This is correct, yes.
So, what do you make? How's he getting on? From you're the fan. I'm not the fan. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But you tell me what you reckon.
Well, it's always gonna be a tough ask, isn't it? Because it's one of those characters that people get very, very possessive of. People feel like they have ownership of a character like the Doctor. And so people care passionately. And Matt Smith was always going to be a very, very tough act to follow. He was fantastic. He was the Doctor for several years. He made some of the best series of any Doctor so far, in my opinion. Some of the most fantastic episodes. I've been rewatching them just lately. They are very, very good. So the poor guy's got a lot to live up to, as Peter Capaldi. He's also got a lot of baggage coming into any series after doing the thick of it, playing the fantastically sweary Malcolm Tucker. And so he's had to tone that kind of thing down just a little bit. And the first series was perfectly good, but the secret weapon that they brought in for the second series, and she's been in both episodes so far, is Michelle Gomez as Missy.
Oh, I think she stole the show.
Isn't she phenomenal?
Yeah, I thought she was fantastic. I think I have to say, I thought she had the best lines. I thought she was really good.
She has the best lines. She has by far the best delivery. You can tell she's having an enormously wonderful time playing what used to be the Master. We finally got evidence that Time Lords can regenerate into Time Ladies. And she's doing it phenomenally. She is reptilian in her evil, and yet so charming and witty with it. You're not, as you said, a huge fan, so you're kind of coming into this a little bit cold. What did you make of her?
She was fantastic. I've got to say, I have not been at all a steady follower of Doctor Who, and I'm not sure if I really get it, Steve. I know you're a big fan, but it's still, it's blending hokey sci-fi with drama and some humour, and it's a mix which you've just got to be in the right headspace for, I reckon. And I wasn't quite buying it. I just some of these, although the special effects are much, much better than I remember as a kid watching this. We see the Daleks' home planet in this new series, the first couple of episodes, and that still looks a bit cardboard cut out a little bit at times for me.
Oh, I think you'd be a bit harsh there.
Well, okay. No, I'm not. And also, maybe it's because I've come back to it after a long time. Someone who's never going to die, who always survives.
Where's the peril?
Where's the peril? Yes. I find some of the explanations of how he escapes from the clutches of the Daleks firing a laser beam at him, and he's able to convert the laser beam into powering his teleporter, and I just kind of was thinking it's getting a little bit, laying it on a little bit thick, but maybe you just, I don't know, do you just accept that that's part of the way Doctor Who works?
Oh, you have to, don't you? I mean, let's face it, in most films, you accept that, you know, the hero's going to live. I mean, Game of Thrones notwithstanding. You know, in most films, like, okay, there's peril in this, but that guy, he's on the top of the poster. I know he's going to survive.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. The destination's not in question here. It's the journey and how you get there that makes the story. So you just have to live with it.
Yeah, you do. Okay, maybe I haven't lived long enough with it to really embrace it fully. I'm still a little bit of a skeptic. But however,
go back and revisit it.
I'll go back.
Go back and watch a few more classic Matt Smith episodes.
I'm old enough to remember the very first Doctor.
Really, though?
William Hartnell? Was that
William Hartnell was the very first back in the early 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, black and white, long white hair.
That's the one, yes.
Yeah, and that was scary for a youngster, I tell you. The Daleks sounded, when you're a kid, the Daleks sounded bloody scary. I remember that.
Oh, they were meant to, but you see, you've let go of that now. You've lost that inner child.
Oh, just quickly before we go, Steve, I just quickly mention, also on television, just before coming back to New Zealand, spent a few days in the UK, just as the Rugby World Cup was starting up, it was really nice that all the matches were on free-to-air TV, on ITV.
How could that possibly work?
I know. I mean, yes, I know you can. Some of the matches here are being shown live on Prime, and that's great. And also they had an app there in the UK, an ITV app, and you could watch any match anytime, live or delayed. Oh, gosh, it just makes me think back to those days when it all ended in, what was it, the 80s sometime.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Sky TV have bought the rights, and as they're entitled to, because that's how unfettered capitalism works.
It is. And I know a lot of people have Sky, but not everyone does, and there'll be still a few who will just have to wait for several hours or a day and the like. But anyway.
They're always round it. I have just come straight from watching the All Blacks in Georgia, because there are ways around it over the internet. You can actually stream ITV live if you can convince your computer to pretend to be in the UK. Having said that, after the performance from the All Blacks I just saw, one finds oneself wondering why one bothers.
So I understand. Might be badass for the week, huh?
Next week, we're going to be taking a look at Crimson Peak, which is a new Guillermo del Toro horror fest, which stars, appropriately enough, Jessica Chastain from The Martian. She's been busy.
She was in the other big space one not that long ago, Interstellar, with the Christopher Nolan film. She likes space movies.
She does indeed. So we'll take another look at Jessica next week.
Lovely. In the meantime, you can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
And that's it. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Fantastic.